Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. Well, we are enjoying another weekend with fresh snow here at the cabin, and I hope you're able to enjoy the January snows in your own favorite way. You might say the theme of today's show is coyotes. To start, here's an episode of Desert Oracle Radio, produced by Ken Lane, January 27th, 2023, and it's titled Encounters with Coyote Man.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. The wind is howling, the coyotes are howling, and there's this terrible hum, a buzzing. I've just been brooding by the fire. There comes a time in life when brooding by the fire is very important. Brooding is one of those many useful parts of life that you cannot admit to anymore. People jump all over you, try to get you committed. Drop you off at a yoga retreat. Brooding just means to be deep in thought, somber, quiet, moodily contemplative, especially in the sense of working over something. In old movies, the writer or the artist is often shown brooding over the typewriter, the scroll, the canvas. So if you're not brooding about it, it's probably not that important. So brood if you like, and watch out for people who don't want any brooding in their presence. It means they're shallow. Anyway, brooding is best done alone by the fire. A week or so back, I was driving my favorite Mojave back roads on a dark midweek night, nobody else on the road. This is usually a brooding sort of drive, because the only better place to brood than a campfire or a fireplace is behind the wheel, alone with the radio and your thoughts and the wild expanse. On this occasion, as occasionally happens, there were some people riding with me. One of them said something strange. It was while we were all talking about coyotes. And he said he'd watched a coyote on the street in Los Angeles at the edge of Griffith Park. And upon reaching the park's lawn and trees, it stood up on its hind legs and strolled into the darkness. Yes, I said, that's a rare thing to see. You're lucky to have seen that. Regular coyotes can stand up on their hind legs, as can the other canines, generally. Any Anybody with a dog taller than a labradoodle knows this when something on the kitchen counter vanishes. Like those nice steaks left out to defrost. There are photographs you can look up of a very alert coyote standing tall to look over a thick clump of brush. There are reasons cactus wrens make their nests several feet above the ground in the thorny branches of a cholla. Coyotes, like their fox cousins, very much enjoy fresh eggs. Snakes, too, especially the clever red racer, the western coach whip. The red racer is a fine climber of trees and can sometimes maneuver around the endless thorns of a cholla cactus. But when you see a coyote casually switch to walking on two legs, striding in the human way, we are beyond the range of regular animal biology. We are in a different realm, which is usually telegraphed by a heightened sense of awareness. An expansion of our everyday reality. Everything seems very different all of a sudden. Whatever seemed important a moment ago, running an errand, listening to the radio, worrying over a late bill or a mean thing somebody said to you, it disappears for a while, just fades away. Because a wild canine, it looks like a wild canine, just gave you the strangest glance. As it walked across the road like the devil himself. Thinking about the stories my grandmother would tell when I was just a child. Ma Dee, we called her. I loved her very much as a small child, but as we both grew older, as her brooding became her primary activity in that big armchair in the corner of the living room, she took on a more sinister aspect. Or maybe she reflected a more sinister aspect within myself. I was the one who always asked her to tell those terrible stories. On those nights when my parents would go out with the neighbor parents and the kids from across the street would come over and sit on the shag carpeted floor around her big old ugly upholstered armchair. You could say she grew up surrounded by nature. The dream of an Echo Park or Oakland resident today. water moccasins, cypress trees heavy with Spanish moss, alligators. Regular flooding, regular waves of tropical disease, pandemics. Nature. And its constant mirror, apparent to us in fleeting moments. The supernatural, omens, portents, divination, prayers answered. And often the answer was a very firm no. The oldest person in the house was about 15, where my grandmother lived with all her brothers and sisters in this rough old house where people got around by foot or by Piro, the dugout canoe. You could go all over in real shallow water. Old man Pierre, my great-grandfather, had been gone a while by then. Then their much younger mother passed away, Caledonia. And so these kids were just out there by themselves, taking care of themselves. Worried about the devil and keeping an eye out for what my Mahdi called the Lugaru. Whether you grew up in Haiti in the French Caribbean or the maritime provinces of Canada or the cool green lands of Normandy and Brittany, you knew of the Lugaru. It is a werewolf. It becomes a werewolf as the result of a curse, sometimes. Usually, in the French versions, the versions that come down from medieval France, the werewolf has been cursed by Christ because the werewolf had been a mortal who failed to keep Lent or failed to follow a certain commandment of Christ. Or, more generally, in Protestant communities, it was just somebody who was not a good Christian, turned into a werewolf by the grace of God. The Lugaru is sometimes called the Rougarou in the various dialects of the Louisiana swamps. Must live out the curse for a certain time, often for 101 days and nights. Yet in the French Caribbean, the Lugaru is much more like Taquits of the Coahuila people of the Southern California deserts and mountains. A witch, a sorcerer who takes the form of a floating ball of fire that haunts the night. While you are sleeping, it passes through the walls and windows, and like the ghost of a flea, it drinks your blood. There are some methods said to prevent the entity from entering: a line of rice or sand outside the door. For the curious spirit cannot help but stop and count all the grains. Or you can leave out a pair of shoes reversed, because the creature, when in that form, will be confounded by its endless attempts to put on the backward shoes. These semi-intelligent balls of light are known to every culture in the world. even the subculture of modern UFO believers who think these mysterious balls of light bouncing over mountains and over swamps and down lonely trails are evidence of spaceships from other galaxies. UFO believers have also shown interest in the English translation of a Dinant term for a sorcerer who takes the form of a beast, a werewolf. The term is skinwalker, and this is because of the relentless marketing of a small cattle property in the northeastern corner of Utah, briefly owned by some ranchers who claimed all kinds of strange encounters there. Maybe it all really happened, just like they said. But we also know that the Salt Lake City real estate developer and now reality television producer who bought the ranch just wants to keep the revenue flowing. But it's not even Navajo country up there. It's Ute, as in Utah. Brigham Young and his followers called their adopted homeland Deseret. But the federal government back in Washington had no interest in validating the mystic naming conventions of the Latter-day Saints, so the state became Utah. Whatever the Lugaroo is, whatever rules it follows, whether or not they match the monster rules you find on the internet, people did seem to dread the existence of the thing. It seemed to be a bad omen. Do shape-shifting coyotes get up and walk when they feel like it? Well, there are many reports of such things from all over. Here's one I found from South Carolina. Quote, went camping when I was 17 with my friends and the ROTC instructor from our school. We're coming back from town on this long dirt road in the mountains. My friends and I were in the back of the truck and he slammed on the brakes. We look over the top of the cab and see this animal walking across the road. It looked like a coyote but was walking on its hind legs. After it crossed, it let out this god-awful screeching sound. When we got back to the campsite, the ROTC instructor made us pack up and leave. He'd been all over the place with the army and had seen some crazy stuff, but whatever we saw scared him to his core. Old Man Coyote wanders the world he created, making trouble. That's the usual story in America. Coyote doesn't like the working life and avoids it whenever possible. Better to get in trouble trying some outrageous scheme than put in the hard, dull work of doing it right. It's his world, after all. He'll do what he wants or die trying. But he always comes back. Coyote always comes back, and he comes back in greater numbers. As our absurd efforts to eradicate coyotes have proven so well. Once this small wolf, the prairie wolf, was only on the Great Plains and in the southwestern deserts. But now, after centuries of trappers and hunters and exterminators and poison bait and cyanide gas bombs and chasing them from helicopters full of hunters with automatic rifles, well, now coyote is everywhere. Chicago, New York City, walking across Griffith Park Boulevard in Los Angeles evening traffic. Sometimes on two legs. It was 1:25 a.m. on May 21st of last year, 2022, when a security camera at the Amarillo Zoo captured a strange image. It looked, people said, like a coyote walking on human legs. Hardly the first appearance of a coyote strolling around in the night up to no good. But the first one seemingly walking on two legs captured by a night vision camera. There's no way to know what's in the picture, of course, and there's a very good reason why our cameras and iPhones can't pick up the same uncanny visions as sometimes baffle us. Yet here is this strange artifact. I've heard it said that maybe it's a furry hanging around outside the zoo at night, part of some online community, but finally driven to leave the computer behind and put on the fursuit and prance around by the giraffe encounter or whatever. You'll see some coyotes very soon. And if you see a coyote look right at you and stand up and casually walk away on its hind legs, hope you don't see that one too often. If you do, call a witch doctor or a priest or something. Park rangers can't help you there. convoy to Zizek's and across the great Mojave Wilderness and beyond. You've been listening to Desert Oracle Radio. We heard some soundscapes tonight by Red, Blue, Black, Silver, wherever he is now. But I'm your host, Ken Lane, wherever I am now. While the era of the Desert Oracle Radio live show has passed into history, I do have a couple of public events in February. First, on the 11th, 2/11/2023, in the beautiful Mojave village of Shoshone, telling some desert stories, I presume, the afternoon of Saturday, February 11th, probably in the museum there. What else? On Monday, February 27th, I will be taking part in Alta Journals event at Skylight Books in Los Angeles. It's free to attend, but you have to RSVP. Not to me, please. To Alta Journal online. Alta Journal just put out that big desert issue that you can find at California Booksellers that has the Desert Oracle thing in it. And while it's true that I'm taking subscriptions again for the moment for Desert Oracle, the pocket-sized periodical about the mysterious American deserts, it's also true that I've got about another 200 emails to get through regarding your address changes and your queries regarding the status of your old subscription and all that. So have patience and you will get a reply, as I will get through all of these and update the database and etc. It's just me out here and I'm not very good at any of this, so please don't yell, because if you do, I will do a hex. And then there's no telling what you'll see stalking around your home late at night, making god-awful screeches. You can go to desertoracle.com and find out more. Good night from the voice of the desert.
It's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGVM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio. I have a special treat for the second half of the show. C. Marie Furman is a writer I got to meet this summer through a mutual friend. I'll tell you more about C. Marie after you hear this next recording. This story is published on emergencemagazine.org if you'd like to read it yourself. But for now, settle in and enjoy Coyote Story, read by the author, C. Marie Furman.
Autumn, Beartooth Front Country. The sky and landscape are buckskin and blue. I am driving my Ford pickup down the roads that encircle the ranch I am living on, caretaking. The little work other than keeping a fire going and feeding the owner's horses is required of me. I am an hour from the nearest town of Mention. From almost anywhere on the ranch, I see no neighbors. I am out driving just to be out, to be looking across the vast distances that have always filled me. This is a land devoid of structures, of obvious human intervention. Here I can imagine. I can dream without intrusion of even a fence line. And those dreams are never lonesome things. They are filled with stories, memory, the call of meadowlark, the huff of a doe muley, the song of coyotes. All my insides find home here and resonate back to me in the enormity of a southern Montana prairie. I come up over a small rise and, in the distance, I see something jump. Once, then again, an awkward jump. Almost sideways, almost a pounce. At first, I think I am seeing a rabbit, perhaps a fox, but the color is wrong, the size. I press down the brake and reach for my binoculars, bring them to my eyes. As I turn the thumb wheel, a brown coyote comes into focus. It throws its head back as if tugging, pulling against some force that holds it in place. Yet I cannot see what. I lift my foot from the brake and roll forward. I don't know when I realize the coyote's left ankle is caught between two horseshoe-shaped jaws of a dull silver trap. I walk from the truck to the coyote. Each step in the reddish-brown soil raises puffs of dirt around my feet. As I grow near, I see how fragile the coyote is, thin, how like my dog Katie's are its amber eyes. Then I see the blood in the soil, the swelling and rawness of an ankle chewed. The coyote had dug at the trap with its free paw. Its mouth was a mud of blood and froth. As I draw closer, the coyote begins to growl, to bare its front teeth. I walk a circle around the animal. I look for ways to spring the trap, but traps such as these are not something with which I am familiar. My breath and words stick when I talk to the coyote. Only platitudes escape. I look toward the passenger window of my blue truck. From inside, I can see my dog Katie looking out at me, her eyes begging the question, "What are you going to do?" One dog in my truck who needs my protection, and one at my feet who inherently knows I am not to be trusted. The sky on that day was the color of the paper on which I write this story. Not white, not gray, caught in the middle somewhere. The color of possibility here, but not when enshrouding the gruesome scene unfolding on the prairie. The sky that day held certainties. The story for the coyote could have only one ending. Winter was coming. There was no doubt about that. The clouds spit, and its drops were cold and sharp against my face. I keep recalling that day. I keep coming back to the coyote story, not because I think I could have done anything different. The fate of the coyote was set in motion when the first white people came west, and it was handed down through the men and myths that made the man from the town of Bridger, who set the trap on that barren hillside, placed a bit of ground beef around it, and yawned open that metal mouth. I would never meet that man, but he would find my reply to the question of his bait. He would, in the prints I left in the dirt, in the metal I destroyed with a maul, know my anger. Yet I was the one guilty of trespass. The law protected his right to trap, to mangle the leg of the coyote, to let it suffer, bleed, and starve for hours, days. My only witness was the prairie. I keep coming back to the coyote story because I forget how it ends for me. There are so many possibilities, but writing it here will set us both straight. And I keep coming back to the coyote story because I work in metaphor, symbol. I see patterns. I find story. The first story is of the coyote and me. The next belonged to those I called in hope that we might save the coyote, the county vet, who would later corner me in my barn when he came over to float my mare's teeth, denied me any help. My friend Ron, from 1,000 miles away, assured me there was nothing else I could do. The third story died with my dog Katie, who I am certain consisted entirely of story. She watched intently that day through the closed window. I do not pretend to know how she translated what she saw, but I am certain that when I got back in the truck, the cursory sniff she gave was not to catch a scent of her wild cousin, but to be certain it was I who sat beside her and drove us back to the house. I left the coyote as I found it and put Katie in my bedroom. I could not bear for her to witness what happened next. Writing teachers have encouraged me not to anthropomorphize nature, while my elders tell me that we, nature and I, are the same. I tend to write on the side of the elders. I believe that trees exhibit emotion, and I am haunted by a young doe, whether sister or mate, that walked around the corpse of a newly shot buck, unable to leave his side out of a devotion I fully understand. And the buck's meat wasn't filled with the bitter taste of regret, but filled me with a desire to live a life worthy of its wild sustenance. Yet another story, a metaphor, a reminder of how, for an hour after my husband had drowned, I lay beside him, holding him, unwilling to let his body be taken from me, to be carried off not for sustenance, but autopsy, cremation. We die so many times in one life. a certain sky that day, too. I did not anthropomorphize the river that carried his last breath away with so much spring runoff. I did not hope that it would somehow consider me and my pain as it did. Though now that I am older, now that I have known 20 more years of rivers, I might tell you they are the most abiding, always returning what they take. Somewhere off the gulf, where the spring runoff finally met with the sea, I believe I retrieved my husband's breaths and made them mine. Older now, 20 or more years, I come back to the coyote story, and I have known some coyotes since, both those taught to me in traditional stories and those who met me in the wild, rearing dens of pups a 15-minute walk from where I now live. Katie was old when she met those coyote parents. We were jogging. They came out from the brush and ran alongside us. It all happened so quickly that I still don't know if it was providence or omen. They did not try to bite either of my dogs. They only paralleled us in the brush and barked as if ushering us off. They were protecting their kin. We had trespassed. The dogs, I will not say, dwelled on that, but I did. Being human in the West, in the moderately wild places I live in, is a threat. No matter how kindly and carefully I walk, the deer will tell you that. The coyote. In the spring, when I am hiking and not hunting, I tell the animals who stop to gaze at me as I gaze back in adoration that I am not to be trusted. I am two people. I will be seeking a different sustenance in a few months. I try to live in a way so as to deserve that. Along the Salmon River in spring, in a place where the previous fall I hunted deer, I once met a young buck and doe. As if I were joking, for I thought I was, I told my partner to stop the truck and ready the camera. I was going to get out and pet them. I stepped out of the truck and walked up to the pair. In no time, I was scratching them behind the ears, and they were gently nudging me with their heads, trying to play. The picture my partner took shows an undeniable happiness. Joy. My arm around the buck, the doe with her nose to my cheek. Would the deer, anthropomorphized, title this picture, Forgiven? My practice of hunting has not changed, nor of praying that the meat I take is ingested by someone who lives a life well enough to deserve it. But who's to judge guilt or innocence? I contain multitudes, Whitman writes. I have known other coyotes as well, albeit from a distance, along roadsides, through scat, at night in song, and this winter, on the eve of my 48th birthday, from a rock above the San Juan River near Bluff, Utah. To my right, hundreds of paintings and peckings left by thousands of years of visitors to this place. To my left, Navajo land. It was late December, but the sun was strong. We, lizard-like, stretched out on the warm rocks and watched as the water rolled by like hammered silver. First, a foursome of ducks came floating along on the current. When they were startled, splashed, and flew off downriver, we spotted the source of their fear, a coyote wandering out of the thick, invasive tamarisk. Then another, and behind them a mostly black Angus ambled out, a yellow tag punched in its left ear. They all walked to the edge of the San Juan and drank together. My dogs watched intently, quietly. The coyotes did not notice us, or if they did, they didn't care. They had the river on their side. I raised my camera and took a picture of the threesome, and then, as if called, all three turned and walked back into that dense brush. The picture, no matter how you look at it, shows three coyotes. Traditional stories about coyote are about a trickster, mocking stories, moral stories, coyote made human, anthropomorphic. In other stories, coyote is protector, his antics a way to keep the other animals safe. We don't tell coyote stories in summer, so I will not go on. But you should know that, at least in my grandmother's stories, magic surrounds coyote. Is there a reverse process for anthropomorphizing? Do animals give animal traits to humans in an effort to live better, to understand us? Would the coyotes on the riverbank tell stories about humans lounging on the rock? What would the moral or lesson be? Would the coyotes see the two people in me? My elders would say that coyote and human are one, the same. I think often about the two people I am. Is that all of me there is? Can I discern one from the other, or have I gotten too close? A friend once asked how it was that I pulled the silver trigger of my .30-06 when it was pointed at the right shoulder of a cow elk on an early winter slope. Something else took over, I told her. I had clicked the safety off and then back on a dozen or more times. My finger moved as delicately past the trigger guard as it does when tracing the bone of my lover's jaw. I am two people. The other one pulled the trigger. The one who writes on the sky the color of month-old snow pushes the U key on this keyboard with her trigger finger, draws it to my lips to say shh when the dogs bark at the sight of a bear and her cubs. Maybe within me are two survivors, one that kills and one that cleans up. There is a metaphor for my life in the river story, the one about the coyote and the cow. It is about my biological parents, one native, one European, Italian. This is the story I was told, the story of me. I am of two people, colonized and colonizer. I am of two continents, maybe more. When do I bring them together? How do I set them free? The story of the coyote and the trap is one I come back to as I write about Native women, how the law protected the trapper, allows sufferings, the removal of pests. Not more than an hour's walk from where the coyote was trapped is the Crow Reservation, a wild horse refuge. Everywhere there is story, ice caves. Native women have been disappearing by the thousands. There is no record of this in federal courts or by police authorities off the reservation. The highest number of disappearing women occur near man camps, those temporary lodgings set up for oil field workers in places such as Williston, North Dakota, under white skies. The county vet would back me into a corner in the barn and say that now that my husband was dead, he could help me, could take care of me. I hid in the basement when he came to my house, my right finger to my lips, asking the dogs to shh. My grandmother prays for all our relations. Is mine the narrative of the West? In this story, I am Crazy Horse. In others, I am Columbus. Which one, my friend asked me, pulls the trigger? How do you know who to trust? I keep coming back to the coyote story because I shot the coyote. Twice. The first time I tried, I stepped out of my truck with a .40 caliber Smith & Wesson handgun in my right hand. I carried it against the flesh of my right thigh. When I got close to the coyote and the coyote paused, I raised the gun. I am trained in firearms, captain of the pistol team in college. I am made of two countries, one colonized and one colonizer. I don't know which one brought the gun I raised. I was close enough not to need to look through the sights. I cupped my left hand under my right, pointed it at the dog, for that is what it is in the end, a dog. My Katie was in the truck behind me, watching. I've known no truer friend. Older now, I come back to the coyote story. I have killed deer and elk since then. I write about the Native experience, about Native women's bodies. I went to a college built on Nez Perce lands and colonial ideals. I bonded with white mentors and argued with white men who told me the land is not stolen, that the Indian was conquered. I am called squaw by those who think that the word can control me. I am asked if I am Mexican or once Greek. What's your bloodline? I was asked once, as if a horse. We are the animals, my elders say. We are many people in one. It was a dog. We should not anthropomorphize. Show, they kept telling me with my poems. Don't tell. I am telling you the story of the woman who shot the coyote twice. I could not kill it, you see, not with a pistol. My right hand started to tremble, eyes amber like my Katie's. I drove the miles back to the ranch house and left Katie inside my room and took my .30-06 from the wall, the .30-06 I would use years later to kill the cow elk, the same rifle I bought for my dead husband the Christmas before he died. I drove the bumpy road back, past the place where I first spotted the animal, past my innocence, my naivete. I parked 20 yards from the coyote and cut the engine. I never closed the door after I got out. I just lay my breast against the warm of the hood and place the coyote's head in the fine crosshairs of my rifle. My finger slid past the trigger guard to the trigger, and I pulled it. Something else took over. But my shot was hasty and ill-placed, and hit the coyote in the back end, blowing apart its hind legs and rendering it motionless, but alive. I keep coming back to the coyote story to try to find out who it was that tossed that rifle back into the pickup and pulled out the pistol, crossed the short distance between us, laid the muzzle of the .40 to the soft spot of hair beneath the coyote's left ear, and pulled the trigger. I am two people. One who kills, one who cleans up. Perhaps there are more. Countless others. Like the river that carried my husband's breath back to me, it carried also the breaths of all the lives it claimed. We are in another world, the elders tell me. I contain multitudes. I drank the river that came from my husband's mouth and carried on my hands the blood of coyote and elk. I can smell the breath still of the county vet and Katie's paws after she ran in grass. Every death is a loss and every memory a birth. How many times can we die in one life and still breathe? I come back to the coyote story as a metaphor for the West. I come back to the story of the coyote for the story of myself. Sometimes I am the one in the trap, unable to chew off my leg, unwilling to simply die. Some days I place the bait. Both metaphors are mine. If coyote are anything, they are survivors. We are one, the elders sing. I keep coming back to the coyote story to try to remember the moments after killing the coyote with exact clarity. I must get it right. Sometimes I see it as if I am watching myself from a distance, with the coyote's eyes, through Katie. From behind the safety of binoculars and windshield and scope. I couldn't shoot the coyote with my pistol because something in its eyes, amber like Katie's, reminded me of a familiar desperation. From a distance, I couldn't see that, until I had to. The muzzle on the soft spot below the ear. The temple, so much like our own. I come back to the story because I still don't know who I killed that day in the Beartooth Front Country. I don't know if mine was an act of benevolence or mercy. I've never returned to that place, not physically, where I killed the coyote. It is lost on the prairie, but perfectly mapped on the landscape of my memory. I sold the old blue Ford. Katie is dead and buried in the woods beyond my house. Two new dogs are in my life. Another man. The county vet, I am told, ran off with someone else's wife. But that doesn't mean he doesn't haunt me, or that I don't harbor the ghost of the coyote. But now all the stories are mine, and in this one, the coyote dies. There is no other way for it to end. Its fragile leg is the leg broken in the trap, pinned to the earth on a small rise in south central Montana. A person in a blue truck pulls up, and the coyote, who knows nothing of mercy, is right to be afraid of this two-legged. The coyote feels more pain before its final release, staring into the green eyes of its destroyer as it dies. The coyote does not anthropomorphize. It knows me only as predator. It sees only one human. In another version of the same story, the coyote lives, though the teller has to imagine the animal free, even if she is no less dead. The woman gets back in the truck, the broken body of a dog, for that's all it really is, isn't it? Lying on the seat beside her. She strokes its fur as she drives, sings the songs her grandmother taught her, and where she finally buries it becomes story.
C. Marie Furman is a poet and author whose work is inspired by the Western landscape. She is the author of Salmon Weather, Writing from the Land of No Return, the poetry chapbook Camped Beneath the Dam, as well as the co-editor of two significant anthologies, Cascadia Field Guide, Art, Ecology, and Poetry, and Native Voices, Indigenous Poetry, Craft, and Conversations. She has poetry and nonfiction published or forthcoming in a variety of publications, including Terrain.org, Emergence Magazine, Alta Magazine, Northwest Review, Yellow Medicine Review, Poetry Northwest, Big Sky Journal, and various anthologies. C. Marie is the director of the Elk River Writers Workshop and an award-winning columnist for The Inlander. She is the associate director and poetry director for Western Colorado University's graduate program in creative writing, where she also teaches nature writing. C. Marie is the host of Terra Firma, a Colorado public radio program. She is a former Idaho writer-in-residence and lives in the Salmon River Mountains of Idaho. So you can catch C. Marie at the following workshops or events. March 15th, 2025 at Salmon River. That's when Writing from the Land of No Return publishes, and it does include the piece you heard today. April 24th, 2025, she will be reading at Elk River Books in Livingston. April 25th and 26th, 2025, she's reading and workshop at River Arts and Books in Roscoe, Montana. June 22nd through 27th, 2025, it's Outpost on the Zumwalt Prairie with C. Marie. August 13th through 16th, she is the director of Elk River Writers Workshop and will host an all-Indigenous workshop. You can find the details at elkriverwriters.org. And you can contact her at www.cmariefurman.com. And I hope we can have an interview with her on an upcoming show. And her last name is spelled F-U-H-R-M-A-N. So again, it's www.cmariefurman.com. It is cold outside, so I've come in for a little bit to warm up. And today are nature readings from Nature A Day at a Time by author, naturalist, and illustrator Kathy Katz. Our reading for January 26th is about houseflies. She begins with a quote from Linda Hogan in First People from Intimate Nature. And Linda writes, "There are ways of knowing and being in the world that have not been available to our own human intelligence, that have only recently entered our perceptual maps, territories, and records. And together, all the different intelligences equal a whole. This, I think, is the telling thing." And the text begins today with, "A loud fly buzzing in the middle of winter is probably the awakening of a housefly who slipped through the door at the end of summer. A housefly can remain dormant until the first warmth reaches it, whether artificial or natural." And then she closes with a quote from Castle Freeman Jr. in Spring Snow. And he writes, "On the coldest day of winter, I'll light a fire in the stove in this room. Then a housefly the size of a piper cub will appear at the window inside. In the way they gather at the windows to look out at the inhospitable winter, they remind me of elderly, well-stuffed gentlemen, members of a venerable and aristocratic club who from the windows of the drawing room look out on the street. And seeing the changed world out there, are grateful to be old. I expect any minute one of those flies will abruptly rustle the pages of his Times and ring for a brandy." The January 27th entry begins, "God in his wisdom made the fly and then forgot to tell us why." And that's from Ogden Nash. And the reading continues, "Much larger and more robust than the common housefly, the horsefly is usually over an inch long. Their eating habits are radically different between male and female and between youth and adult. Female horseflies suck blood from mammals, but Males live on pollen and nectar, and their offspring feed on aquatic animals. The female needs the protein in mammal blood to nourish her eggs. Her familiar erratic flight pattern is seemingly random as she buzzes wildly from flesh to plant, fields to streams. But each season, she manages to lay thousands of eggs attached to vegetation near streams, ponds, and lakes. When the eggs hatch, the larvae fall into the water and spend the next two winters on the muddy bottom before emerging as adults. A raft of her eggs is shown here, greatly enlarged. And if I were to describe this to you, I would say it looks almost like a wing. And then she closes with a quote from John Briggs and F. David Peat in Seven Life Lessons of Chaos. And they write, "Chaos theory shows us how apparently tiny and insignificant things can end up playing a major role in the way things turn out. By paying attention to the subtlety, we open ourselves to creative dimensions that make our lives deeper and more harmonious." My thanks to Ken Lane and Red Blue Black Silver for sharing their work on Desert Oracle Radio. Thanks to C. Marie Furman for sharing her reading with us today. Thanks to KGVM and its supporters. And thank you for listening. If you want to reach me, the number is 406-404-6246. You can hear this program live on the air at 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 Sunday nights and 9 Monday mornings. Our past shows are also available on demand on the kgvm.org website. I'll be back next week with more desert and mountain lore for you. Until then, stay well and sweet dreams. And thanks to the National Park Service and Neil Herbert for the coyote songs along the Gibbon River in Yellowstone National Park, January 31st, 2014, to take us out.